1027 Business with Michael Avery.
We will be focusing increasing attention on climate issues on the show as we build up to Glasgow and COP26 in November. And chatting to a friend who works in climate consulting the other day, he's deeply skeptical about net zero claims because he says at the global level, all historical energy transitions have seen humanity stack a new source of primary energy onto an existing source, and they themselves have continued to grow. So yes, even traditional biomass, we have never managed to leave a primary energy source behind. So the 1.5 degree proposition is that we have to leave three now, coal, oil and gas, behind almost completely over the next 30 years. And he reckons this is bordering on delusional. Yet the IPCC's new report is ringing the alarm bells louder than ever before on the urgency of the situation. Well, to talk about the new report, I'm joined by Campbell Parry, analyst at Investec Wealth and Investments. Campbell, welcome to the show. If you've been living under a rock, what is the IPCC process all about?
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me. Well, the IPCC, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is a United Nations body set up specifically to investigate climate change. And they put out their inaugural report as far back as 1990, and there's been various iterations since then. 2013 was the last comprehensive report, and now 2021. It's almost a 4,000-page report. Luckily for all of us, there's a 40-page summary. But it really is another scientific reminder that we just aren't moving fast enough on the critical issues related to climate change. It really illustrates the gravity of the challenge that we all face. And it's not just climate. It's also all the associated factors like water, food, clean cities and healthy people.
Now, what is the key message in the report?
I think the key message is to show a link between human activities and global warming. It said that CO2 levels, it confirmed that CO2 levels in the atmosphere are the highest in 2 million years. It also flagged that global temperatures had risen by 1.1 degrees from the pre-industrial era. And you must remember that 1.5 degrees was the initial Paris target. So we're almost there in 2021. And those, I think, were the key findings. You know, it was taken seriously because it is the collective effort of a large group of scientists who reviewed something like 14,000 papers on climate change. So people have taken it very seriously.
And if you look at the situation now, as you said, we're already up 1.1 degrees. The report reckons another 1.5 degrees in the next 20 years, so well in excess of Paris. And we've got this carbon budget, this so-called carbon budget, and it's much like a household budget. You've got a limited amount to spend. Can you just describe how this scenario of a carbon budget is fleshed out through the report and what is left at current emissions run rates?
Well, I think, you know, if you have a look at the amount of emissions that we are allowed to emit, the theoretical amount of emissions that we're allowed to emit in order to achieve net zero, we're already three quarters of the way through the amount we are allowed to emit. So we are well on our way to exceeding that carbon budget. I think in the end, the solution here is not so much about carbon budgets, but it's about actually governments having to change the rules of the game. You know, billions of people have to change their ways. We need thousands of companies, hundreds of governments to all get together to put a price on carbon. I think the carbon budget is secondary to the importance of putting a price on carbon, putting a price on our activities, and, you know, to make people or make the entity that create the problem in the first place ultimately pay for it.
And there's, as I said in my introduction, the skepticism around net zero, and there are quite a few reasons why it's going to be a real stretch target. Why do you think net zero is going to be a real challenge?
Well, I think one of the most important reasons is just politics. You know, these pledges aren't legally binding, and they are particularly unpalatable sometimes. Some of the changes that they have to make are unpalatable in the minds of politicians, least of all actually regulating these things. The problem is that in the United States, it's notoriously fickle, and the dispensation there can change every 4 years. And then we're nothing without actually getting China on board. You know, they make a lot of noise about net zero by 2060. There's a lot of coal being installed in that country. Last year, there was 38 gigawatts of coal installed. And next 5 years, 180 gigawatts of coal-fired power is planned. So they make a lot of noise about net zero and the installation of renewable energies. But at this point in time, you know, the three largest economies on Earth are really, it seems, paying lip service to net zero. I think geopolitics is another big issue. We're already seeing this kind of subtle confrontation between the US and China in the context of who's controlling the electrons. In the past, the world's economy has been governed by who controls carbon in the form of natural gas and oil. Going forward, it's going to be who controls the electrons to the new future electrified economy. And China's been very prescient, going out and owning cobalt, nickel, copper mines, manufacturing components for EVs and renewables, and being the number one installer worldwide of wind and solar and a leading EV player. So there are serious, you know, that's already ruffling feathers, and there are serious geopolitical ramifications down the road. And then there's some more subtle issues, like there just is not enough metal to allow net zero to happen. And even if there was, you know, would the effect be as expected? It, you know, it's highly costly. It costs $2 trillion over 10 years to increase renewable share by 2% of the mix without any discernible impact on climate. And you must remember that decarbonization itself is very fossil fuel intensive. For every $1 trillion we work out in green capex that needs to be spent, that increases oil demand by 100,000 barrels per day. So it just seems to me that without everybody coming together, because there's this view that we can do one thing at a time, but we just have no option. If we want to get to net zero, we have no option to do one thing at a time. We all have to work together with an unprecedented level of global cooperation. So it just seems hard to see.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said in my introduction as well, to leave three fossil fuels behind and just rely entirely on one new system is almost in cloud cuckoo land. If you look at the practical realities and the real politics of the day, and you wrote a very interesting article for Investec where you say that net zero is going to require 18 times the renewable energy capacity of 2020. And to your point, do we have the metals? No, we don't. So how important is hydrogen to all of this? Because we're having this conversation in South Africa at the moment. There seems to be a lot of time, effort, research and development going into the hydrogen economy. Is that promising in this context?
Absolutely. It is a fantastic energy storage option in the future, but at the moment it's very expensive and very, very energy intensive. So, you know, really interesting hydrogen, but only a longer term option. I think the key thing, and you mentioned the three big energy sources, coal, oil and gas, and I think the key thing there is, and this is in the shorter term, is to embrace carbon capture and storage, what we like to call blue energy. So allow fossil fuels to continue as part of the energy mix, but try as much as you can and put a lot of effort and money into carbon capture and storage, which has been around for some time, but it certainly will provide a sort of intermediate option before hydrogen comes to the rescue, probably post-2030.
And what about gas? Again, there's a lot of controversy around the car power ships at the moment, but many energy economists reckon that gas does have a role to play as a bridging fuel to get us to a more renewable-based system. What role do you see gas playing?
Exactly what you just said. You know, the emissions from gas, it's a far more carbon-efficient energy source than coal, something like 40% less emissions. And many of the older coal utilities around the world, including here in South Africa, can be fairly quickly and easily retrofitted with gas power. So I completely agree with what everyone has said. And I think the key word there is an intermediate source. It can kind of bridge the gap between now and then.
And then nuclear. I know nuclear got a bad rap in South Africa because of its links during the state capture years to the RET faction and Russia and those kinds of things. Stripping out the politics of it, what do you make of nuclear?
Well, I like to think maybe they sort of something, because I think nuclear is a highly efficient, clean source of baseload power with very low operating cost and very well understood technology. As you said, it does get a bad rap, but you must remember that more people die every year from coal and working in coal mines and the effects of coal than have ever succumbed to nuclear accidents. So I think nuclear is an extremely viable option, and it should be something that we're embracing more readily. And it's interesting because as we speak, and they're obviously keeping it quite quiet, both the Japanese and the United States are really pushing hard on their on their nuclear program. In fact, Japan, I think last I looked, was recommissioning many of the reactors that had been taken down post-Fukushima.
So that does tell you, often they say, watch the smart money in the room, watch the smart economies in the room, and Japan certainly right up there. So bottom line here, Campbell, what do you think will help make a real difference and faster? Because the one thing from the IPCC report is that things are urgent.
Yes, that's right. Well, as I said earlier, the number one thing is that governments have to change the rules. We have to put a price on carbon, and we have to make the entity that creates this problem pay for it ultimately, whether the, and that can be consumers, can be companies, and can be governments. I think the other thing is we need to put more money and effort into carbon capture, because as you said, we can't get away from the use of coal and fossil fuels. And as long as we can capture the carbon and do it at scale, because at this point in time it hasn't been rolled out in scale, but if we can get technology up the curve, then it can be a very, very useful thing for fossil fuels. I think we need to stop ignoring nuclear. As I mentioned earlier, a very, very efficient form of baseload power. We need to embrace gas. You can retrofit a coal-fired utility very quickly with gas. And we need to push hard on hydrogen, because there's an immense potential in hydrogen as an energy source. So we'll have to see, but as I said, that's a long way out. There are various other things too. There's a lot of technology that's being done on internal combustion engines to make them more efficient. There are some developments underway to produce a hydrogen combustion engine, which is really interesting. And then there's all the things which are bubbling away in the background, like biofuels and renewable diesel, and things like geothermal and offshore wind, which still have a lot to contribute, but sometimes have their own issues related to where they are and the cost.
Campbell Parry, thank you very much for the bright green analysis of the IPCC report. Analyst at Investec Wealth and Investment here on Hot Business.
Hot 102.7 Business with Michael Avery.